Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's also the associate director of its Middle East Studies program. She's a board member of the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolitions, U.S. branch, a founder of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project, and she's also a freelance journalist. We picked a good time to go on. I scheduled Jennifer some time back, but the ongoings in Madison and across Wisconsin are very active, and the courage of the people, of the public workers, the state workers, and their supporters, and people coming in from out of town, from out of state, supporting them, it really is heroic. I just hope they hold firm and hold the line and keep working against what I refer to as dark forces that have nothing but ill in mind for these people. They want them to have no rights whatsoever. That's the bottom line of what's going on. They're talking about increasing worker contributions for health care and pensions and so on. Well, that's an issue in my mind, and I wouldn't go along with that readily, but that's one issue. Taking away collective bargaining rights means they'll have none whatsoever. You get rid of the collective bargaining, and unions are simply left on their own, and all their rights will disappear sooner or later without collective bargaining. It took many years of hard struggle to win collective bargaining in the 1930s, and those rights have eroded steadily ever since. And right now they're on the ropes, faced with the possible elimination from one state to another state. And if one does it, another does it, another does it, another does it, and then they're all gone. Jennifer, are we connected?
Yes, we are.
Can I mention one other thing?
Yes, please.
I had a very active morning. I just finished back-to-back interviews on Russia Today television. The topic was Libya, and maybe we can bring that into the conversation as well, because I have very strong opinions about what's going on there, which is the exact opposite of the rubbish, the propaganda, the wall-to-wall lies coming across in the U.S. media and the BBC and Al Jazeera and sadly all the rest of them, but not on Russia Today.
That's interesting.
And they gave me, I think, an extended interview with a host from Moscow. We did it via Skype on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm propped up extra high in my chair right now with everything in the back of me swept away so I don't look too messy as the background. I'm not sitting with a bookcase as my background. I'm in my kitchen, as a matter of fact.
What a nice place to do an interview.
So I did not want odds and ends sitting in the background, but then they called me back to tape more. We did about another 10 or 12 minutes that will air on Monday, and we picked up the discussion with a few other points, but I literally just finished about 4 minutes before being connected on here with you.
Wow, that's a lot of interviewing.
Oh, well, I am ready for a full hour. And Jennifer, as Ernie Banks used to say in Chicago, the famous baseball player, let's play two. I could easily do an hour. I could do 2 hours. I might need a slight pause in between, but I could easily do both. But
yeah,
let me
I know.
Let
I feel like
jump.
I could talk about these all day.
I have lots of energy. I could keep this going for a lot more hours before this day ends. But it will end, and I will tire. I am not Superman.
And I will be up at the Capitol protesting this interview.
Jennifer, you're right there in the middle of it, and you're a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about it from your perspective.
Well, from my perspective, it really looks like an assault on not only the middle class and working class people of Wisconsin, but a major assault on the university. I assume that you've heard that our chancellor is looking to privatize the University of Wisconsin, turning it into a kind of Ivy League school. This would get rid of state funding pretty much altogether and allow private foundations and corporations to invest in the university. I think the most serious implication of it, however, is that it would cause tuition to skyrocket through the roof. Tuition could be raised by as much as 20%. And what are the real effects of that kind of a tuition hike? The real effects are that those who can afford to go to school can continue to go to school at the University of Wisconsin, which is a very good university, and those who cannot will have to go elsewhere. And that's something that these big state universities, to my mind, were supposed to be preventing. They were supposed to be for the public good, for the common good, places where all the state residents could certainly go and afford, people from out of state end up paying slightly higher tuitions, but they're also going to a big state public institution. By privatizing the UW, we are turning ourselves into a subsidiary of an increasingly plutocratic society, plutocratic and oligarchic, one that is run by wealthy millionaires and their sponsors, one that is backed by corporations and foundations, right-wing think tanks, and one that basically has very little regard for the rights and the concerns of the common people.
Oh, I absolutely agree, Jennifer. It is outrageous. I have another wonderful guest who comes on this program, and she lives in Los Angeles. And many years ago, she attended the University of California system when tuition was free.
Mm-hmm.
Tuition was free.
That's amazing.
That's what a state university should be. It should be an extension of public primary and secondary schools to educate people. And I think I can translate really what privatization means, Jennifer, and I really believe this. The idea is to educate not everybody who wants to go, but only the ones that ideally who they want to have an education.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you get rid of the people you don't want to educate is simply price it above their ability to afford, and then they cannot attend. And I think that's the dirty scheme.
And it's also one that is being billed as necessary to help the state's budget deficit. But what I want to stress is that it is completely unnecessary, that the sources of wealth are here in the state, and that even in poor countries like Mexico, which is terribly poor and has many, many social problems, far more than the United States, it still manages to have very good public education and public universities, which speaks to the lies that we've been hearing here in Wisconsin from the governor, that somehow we aren't paying our share of the budget or taking our share of the responsibility for the budget, and that we have to tighten our belts and pay more to our pensions and our benefits in general in order to make the budget work. We have a budget deficit, as do most of the U.S. states. The budget deficit has been caused by many different things. Privatizing universities and cutting collective bargaining rights of the unions, of the public sector unions, these are not necessary steps to correct the deficit.
Oh, exactly right. And the deficit is being used as a pretext
for all kinds of things.
All kinds of policies that that these people wanted to institute long ago, but they needed hard times as a pretext to be able to do it. The old line, and I quoted Rahm Emanuel a couple of times years back. He gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal, and he said something like, a crisis is too important an event not to take advantage of to mm-hmm. be able to do things you can't do any other time. And, of course, what he meant was strip ordinary people of rights that you don't dare go after when times are good. But when times are bad, you plead poverty and you say we have deficits and we can't afford it. Well, it's simple to get around these deficits. Tax the rich.
Tax the corporation.
Stop the imperial wars. Close the overseas U.S. bases.
Absolutely. And I think so few people, you know, it's easy to be convinced when you see headlines like we saw in the Wisconsin State Journal earlier this week, headlines that read, Wisconsin is broke. Wisconsin's not broke. We're not broke. We have money. We have all kinds of places from which to draw funds. We certainly can tax the rich. We can tax corporations that come into the state. We can raise taxes on food, restaurants, sales, regular sales taxes, cigarettes, gasoline, alcohol. There's absolutely no reason to scare the average person into thinking that unless he or she gives up another portion of their paycheck, that the state is somehow going to go under. Worse to me is that that is being used, as you correctly said before, as a pretext to do something much worse, which is to disempower the last real voice there is coming from the public sector in the state by cutting or stopping collective bargaining across the board for public sector unions, perhaps with the exception of the firefighters and the local police, who, by the way, joined with the protesters a week ago. So there are a lot of things that go into this whole process, lies that feed into bigger lies, scare tactics that sound very real and very threatening, but when examined closely, turn out to be nothing more than that, just scare tactics to get people to believe that somehow they have to give up more so that the rich people, the rich corporations, so that big money and investments, so that they can continue to run our country like an oligarchy. I find that absolutely offensive. I think it's time for people to realize how frightening democracy is to our leadership. It's terrifying to them, the idea that people could actually control the policies of their country is anathema to what corporate wealth and corporate power want to support.
Oh, again, so true, Jennifer. I've done a fair. I address a lot of topics in my articles, and one of them that I've written a fair amount about, I guess I could call it privatized money. There is no question that the root cause, the absolute root cause of all of the so-called budget and other problems that we hear about all the time, the root cause is privatization. And the worst privatization is privatized money. And by that I mean the Federal Reserve, which is an agent of Wall Street, controlled, owned, literally owned by Wall Street, listens to this program, understand it very well. I don't have to explain it. But that is the root cause, and they are the ones that manipulate economies and manipulate events to create crises that they, as Rahm Emanuel said, that they can take advantage of that they could not do if these crises did not exist. So you destroy small businesses, or you buy up assets on the cheap, so you get bigger, so you merge, so an oligopoly becomes a monopoly. I mean, the oligopolies are monopolies anyway, because they all have interlocking directorates. They sit on each other's boards, mm-hmm. including the media on a bank's board and a bank CEO on a media company's board, on an oil company's board, on a defense contractor's board. They're all in the same dirty business together, and that's to make more money.
And they get very upset when Joe Average says that he wants to have a voice in his government. Or Jane wants to have a voice in her government. What the only thing I disagree with you on is that I don't think that we have to that the powers that be that want to keep this preserve this system. I don't think they have to do it only in times of crisis. In fact, what is frightening to me is how much our neoliberal economic policies have been broadened across the United States, across the globe, in fact, much to the chagrin of many South countries.
Oh, you're so right, Jennifer. I absolutely agree with you. Can I restate what I said?
Sure.
In times of the neoliberal 90s, look at all the damage we did there, including destroying the ex-Soviet countries and South Africa and wreaking all kinds of problems in so many other places. I would say in times of crisis, you can accelerate and do more than you could do during non-crisis periods.
You can accelerate the process. That's exactly what I would think. But what I was going to say is simply that we don't even need crises to put these policies into action, and there are lots of reasons for that. All you have to do is go to the campaign, presidential campaigns or the political campaigns, to see how little the democratic process as we understand it is working. Special interests, corporations now are the same as individuals. They can speak with a voice of an individual, although, you know, they have 10 times the wealth and the power. And when our elected officials are being elected not by the people of a state or of a country, but by wealthy corporations, special interest groups, military economic mechanisms that I believe control this nation as well as the process of globalization, then we're drifting fairly far away from anything that is democratic in the first place.
I like to call this country, Jennifer, a rhetorical democracy. I certainly don't see the elements of real democracy in it. And again, you're right. You've got big money buying politicians, putting the people in office that they want. Certainly all the people in positions of power, there are small positions, small district, congressional districts that simply don't make any difference one way or the other. But all of the positions of power, the leadership positions on the committees and the majority and the minority leaders and the speaker and, of course, the person who gets to be president and vice president, these people are all very carefully screened and chosen for their role. So they're literally tools of the same system. And it does not matter whether you're talking about an Obama or a Bush or a man or a woman in the moon. It
mm-hmm.
makes no difference whatsoever. It's the power structure that goes on. It doesn't change. It only seems to get worse. It certainly does not get better.
For me, the Obama administration is more dangerous and in some ways worse than the Bush administration, because it presents a facade of progressivism and progressive politics to the people of this country, and yet has moved to the right of the Bush administration on a number of critical issues, including civil liberties, tax policies, keeping places like Guantanamo and Bagram prisons open, not shutting these down as Obama was determined to do when he first came into office. You know, I have friends who insist that Obama just has a tougher time fighting with the powers that be and that we have to give him a chance. I don't think that's true. I think he's falling in step with what they want. He's very well liked by Wall Street right now because he's giving Wall Street exactly what it wants. And when Wall Street goes under, as it did in 2008, Obama will turn around and bail it out. When the states fall into these huge deficits, where is Obama? I keep wondering, why hasn't he been to Madison? Why hasn't he been here to support the rights of the working class and middle class people? Why hasn't he spoken up on behalf of the Democrats in this state, whom he supposedly represents, who are saying now, we're not going to let you have our collective bargaining rights? Where is he? For that matter, you know, where are many people? I see Scott Walker on the news every night, but I don't see very much of the reporting covering the demonstrations. You may have heard already that Fox News had a clip of quote-unquote Wisconsin demonstrators rioting and causing chaos, and in the background of the clip were palm trees. I mean, in other words, in the middle of February, this was February last week, people in Wisconsin were causing chaos on the streets by demanding their rights. Well, of course, the protests here have been completely peaceful and nonviolent. In fact, I think the protests here have been some of the most ruley and considerate protests I've ever seen. I've never seen anything like it. We've kept the Capitol building as clean as possible. We pick up the trash around the Capitol after we leave. I don't see any kind of chaos going on. There are people who went to the Tea Party a section of the protest to try to have a kind of peaceful dialogue with these people, and yet we still have these news agencies like Fox trying to depict us as ruffians causing problems. Now, this is the people. These are the savages that you have to control, that you can't give real power to, because if you do, they're going to demand an equal distribution of the wealth.
Jennifer, they're doing the same thing in reporting about Libya, not just Fox, but all the others, CNN and the other networks. They are putting out stock footage, not real footage of what they say is going on the ground. It's all fake about the so-called attacks taking place. Oh, there definitely is violence on the ground, but the footage they're showing, I can't believe showing Madison with palm trees in the background.
Well, I didn't see that clip, but I heard about it from a number of people who were just and you go to the demonstrations and see people carrying signs saying things like Fox News will lie about this, and it's so funny because, of course, that's exactly what happens. You know, Fox News shows Madison rioters and palm trees in the background. Well, let me tell you something. If there were palm trees in Madison right now, I'd be much too warm and happy to protest. We're in snow and ice and cold weather for another couple of months at least.
Oh, indeed.
And, I tell you, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I get the creeps thinking who is benefiting from portraying us like some kind of savage people. Who is benefiting from betraying the people as such a threat to the government? My understanding of democracy has always been that the voice of the people is a fairly sane voice, and you know, that it should be heard, that it should be what causes a leader to make his or her decisions is the will of the people, and yet everything I see happening around me is an effort to stifle that voice. And I think the collective bargaining issue is probably the most significant in that sense. Don't let labor unions have a say in whether there are going to be layoffs on the spur of the moment. Well, gee, I think those unions were put into power in the first place to prevent the kind of exploitation that was taking place. Now they're trying to take that away, and we have to say to ourselves, well, then the reason must be because they aren't getting, they're not exploiting people. as much as they would like. And I want people to understand that. I want people to understand that we, the people of the state of Wisconsin, are a major threat to the governor and his private corporate backers.
And again, I think Scott Walker, the governor, represents more than just the hardliners in Wisconsin, and the same thing in Ohio under John Kasich, a governor of Ohio, former congressman. They already have a bill that I don't know if it passed the Senate on a rigged, literally rigged the procedure. You talk about a vote that went the other way, and they literally turned it around in Ohio to strip collective bargaining, Jennifer. There were Republicans who were upset about the provision, and they were committee members. The bill had a clear committee before it went to a full Senate floor vote, and it only passed the Senate floor, Republican-dominated, by one vote, but there were two Republican committee chairmen who wanted to vote no, and they were stripped of their committee membership, taken off the committee, replaced by two Republicans who would vote yes to get a committee majority to take the bill to the full Senate floor, where the Republicans had a majority in the Senate, and they could pass the bill, and they did. And the House will be easier. The House either did pass it or will pass it. And Kasich, who is the Scott Walker of Ohio, mm-hmm. he will sign the bill, and the public workers of Ohio will lose their collective bargaining rights. So, you know,
Scary. It's scary. I think I wish that people who can't or don't want to follow what's happening would understand how important their activism, their presence and involvement in this process is, because without mobilization from the bottom up, this nation is going to turn into nothing more than an oligarchy, which is more or less what it has been. But institutionally, we still have safeguards to protect the voices of the people. When I see that the powers that be want to take those safeguards away, I want to shout to the people around me, you've got to stop this, because, you know, if this goes, you're going to find yourself in boiling water, and it'll be too late to get out. It'll be too late to turn things back. Now is the time to be acting to prevent these last steps from being taken. Now is the time to get out and say, no, sorry, Governor Walker, you are not going to do this. You are not going to break the people of Wisconsin so that you can benefit, you and your Koch brothers and your corporate interests who don't have to pay any taxes into the state. You're going to benefit by taking our last rights away? No, that's not going to happen. So anybody hearing this, and it's the same for any other state, people have got to get up and get involved and say, we're not letting this happen. This is a democracy. I'd like to bring up the issue that you mentioned earlier in the show, which is also the fact that why are we in such dire straits economically in this country? We're in dire straits economically because for the last 6 decades, we've been fighting these adventurous wars overseas and paying out trillions and trillions of dollars to the gun belt and the weapons industries. I have a brother who has recently laid off his work in Washington State, and the only work he can find within an hour and a half radius of where he lives is work with Boeing, that has contracted recently to build more fighter planes. What does that say about the basis of our economy? We have a military economy, and with a military economy, we have to have a foreign policy that pursues these wars that are not defenses. I hate the term defense budget. because our budget has nothing to do with defense.
Oh, absolutely.
It has to do with exploitation, offense, aggression, and the ruining and destroying of people's countries and lives overseas that we aren't even allowed to see on our television screens.
Oh, you're so right, Jennifer.
The media self-censors.
Jennifer, we need to take a break. And it was after World War II that the Defense Department was called the Defense Department. Before it was rightfully named, it was called the War Department. It has nothing to do with defense. This country has not had an enemy since the end of World War II. No enemy whatsoever. The so-called Defense Department is a war department, and it's there to begin new wars. And if one ends, with heaven forbid in their minds, the name of the game is find a new enemy, and they don't exist, so you have to invent them.
We have invented good enemies, and in the next segment, I'd love to talk about one enemy that is not an enemy, and that is Iran.
Oh, and I would love to talk about that. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back, and also explain what will be going on this weekend in Wisconsin. But
okay.
let's take a quick break.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network, Fridays at 3 p.m.
Is a state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there or be square.
I'm Steve Barnett. I'm your host for the Paradise Parking Lot, an environmental program on the Progressive Radio Network. We're on the air from 1 to 2 Eastern Time every Wednesday. And we talk about everything environmental. This is an hour show, so there are no sound bites. This is a deep discussion of controversial environmental issues. We provide information. We provide guides to action. We have wonderful guests. For example, we've had John Holdren, President Obama's science advisor. We've had Jaron Lanier, the creator of virtual reality. This program is designed for anyone who's interested in the environment and deepening their understanding of how our planet is changing and what we can do about it.
Hi, I'm Daryl Clark.
Bob Levis.
Ron Waits.
And we're your Progressive News Weekly team here on Progressive Radio Network.
Shank of the Morning, the Shank of the Week, Wednesdays, 10 a.m., 11 a.m.
We are you as if you had a mic in your hand the way we do.
It's news you can use. News for you, by you, and of you.
Grassroots activism.
That's all she wrote, folks.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
On with Jennifer Lowenstein, talking about Wisconsin and so many other things. You can take any issue at all and so many other things, including current events going on that seem to be different, really are related. So, you know, attacking workers and imperial wars and crooked Wall Street bankers and governments at the federal, state, and local level. My own Chicago is a microcosm of what's going on in the whole country. And I think more than ever, with a former White House chief of staff to become mayor in mid-May.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't quite get that. I don't know what his – I don't trust him as far as I could throw him.
Neither do I.
What on earth was his reason for suddenly dropping his role in Washington, D.C. and running for the mayorship of Chicago? Something's rotten in Denmark.
You know, there may be. He said it was his longtime dream to be the mayor of Chicago, but he couldn't do it until Richard Daley decided he didn't want to run anymore. And after 20 years, Richard Daley said, well, you know, I'm getting around 70 years old. Maybe it's time to do something else. So he is at six terms, and he's not running again. I mean, the machine runs to Chicago, and Emanuel said he wanted the job, but he is a disgusting human being. I, among other things, Jennifer, I call him rightfully an unindicted war criminal. So Chicago, for the first time, will have an unindicted war criminal as its mayor. What a distinction.
And I don't understand his motivation for this. I mean, why does he want to be mayor of Chicago? This has to be connected to something broader than domestic policies. I hate to sound so suspicious, but I don't trust this person at all. I think he has motivations that we don't know about yet, and you know, it's just too unusual for somebody up in the circle of the president to drop out and run for a mayor's race. Something just doesn't rub me the right way.
Can I throw in one sidebar
that
adds a little credence to what you're talking about? The Illinois Supreme Court greased the wheel for Emanuel to run. According to Illinois law that has been on the books since the 19th century, nobody can run for public office statewide, community-wide, unless they have been a resident of the state for 12 months prior to running for office. Well, Emanuel was not a resident for 12 months. He was a very short-time resident. And the Illinois Supreme Court did the equivalent, in my mind, of what the U.S. Supreme Court did for George Bush in 2000,
mm-hmm.
annulling the popular vote, defiling the Constitution, and deciding the people don't matter, only we do, and really only five justices because they went 5-4. It was even worse in Illinois. We have seven Supreme Court justices in Illinois. It was a unanimous decision to simply ignore the state law and say, Emanuel can run for mayor. He was way ahead in the polls. He was a shoe-in. The only unknown was, would he win on the first round? He needed a majority. If not, there would be a runoff. He won in the first round. So it was a rigged process to get him elected.
It sure struck me that way. And, you know, I hesitate to talk too much about this topic because I would need to read more about it to speak more, I guess, more freely on it. But there's something about it.
I don't hold back for a minute.
there's something about it that just doesn't set right with me. And
it has a distinct aroma to it, Jennifer, I must say. And, of course, the same thing in Wisconsin. And you brought up Iran, so we don't diverge too much.
Mm-hmm.
Let me throw in one thing, and then you talk about Iran.
All right.
There is no society anywhere that's perfect, and certainly not Iran. And if I have one objection above all others is I believe in a strict separation of church and state. I do not believe that you mix religion, no matter which one it is, with politics. I think they should be entirely separate, and there should be a divide,
mm-hmm.
an absolute divide between the two. Well, Iran is not that at all. The mullahs have the final word, and that I disagree with. But their elections, I believe, they're not perfect. But I believe they are more perfect, they are better than the ones we run in America, and I want to put in a plug for state-controlled Press TV. They have me on practically as a regular, practically mm-hmm. as a regular. I have long lost count of how many times they've had me on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I have to go to a downtown studio to pick up a satellite feed. Other times we do it over the telephone. I had one interview last week. I had three interviews with them the week before. The topics vary. They let me speak freely, just the way I do on my own program, just the way I did on Russia Today earlier, just the way I do when anybody interviews me, and they must like what I'm saying because they keep inviting me back. And the things I can say on Press TV are absolutely suppressed on all the U.S. major media.
Mm-hmm.
So call Iran what you will, they sure have a more open media than we have in this country.
Well, I've had the same experience with Press TV, and I'm always amazed at how much we are allowed to say that it has to be stifled, muffled here. In fact, I had an experience recently where I gave a talk on Iran that so deeply upset the audience because it went against what their media had been telling them that I was disinvited from an engagement that was to follow this last one. And they didn't even have the nerve or the guts to tell me the truth, that I was uninvited because I was too threatening. What I was telling them about Iran ran counter to what they've been hearing on the news, and their audiences are not ready to hear it.
And of course, what they're really saying to you, Jennifer, is their audiences are not ready to hear the truth.
No, of course not. They want to have a good time and party and not have to worry about what's happening anywhere else outside of their own hometown. And when you tell them that Iran does not threaten the United States militarily or in any other way for that matter, that upsets the indoctrination that they've had from our media and our politicians. And it just can't be true.
Iran has not attacked another country in over 200 years. They have not done it. They have defended themselves when they were attacked, but they have not committed an act of aggression for over two centuries, where America does it repeatedly, over and over and over and over. You could literally say on a daily basis, because the countries either we occupy, Jennifer, or the ones that the puppet governments we installed run, or you could say occupy, they attack their people on a daily basis, where you do not see Iran committing an act of aggression. So, again, they're not perfect.
Well, also, just looking at facts, Iran has a conventional armed forces that is defensive only in capability. Iran can't really attack another nation. It doesn't have the military capability to do so. I mean, this is looking at it from a very realpolitik point of view, but that happens to be the truth. I don't think Iranians are better or worse than any other people on the planet. And very often when you have the means to go and exploit another people or another country, you take the opportunity when it presents itself, which is exactly what the United States has done. But to portray Iran as somehow this looming threat to the United States or to U.S. military is ludicrous. Iran's weapons capability is really in many ways antiquated. They don't have a nuclear bomb. The recent national intelligence estimates that we have on Iran is that they stopped any kind of nuclear weapons program in early 2003, that they are at least 10 years away from building a bomb under the best of circumstances, and that when their leaders say that they don't want a nuclear bomb, they have reason to be telling the truth, namely that the minute Iran acquired a nuclear weapon, we would have a pretext to, as Hillary Clinton so delicately put it, to obliterate them. Well, Iranians, whether we're talking about the government or the people, are not suicidal. They don't want U.S. or Israeli warships, airplanes, F-16s, going over Iranian airspace and obliterating the land and the people. So they're not going to build nuclear bombs. What the Iranian leadership, as I understand it, would like is to have what is called nuclear threshold capability. In other words, they would like the know-how to produce a nuclear bomb, because it's the know-how, it's the capability, it's the understanding of how to build a bomb that will provide a deterrent in the region to countries like Israel that is aggressive on a regular basis. Once Iran acquires a real deterrent to Israel, which is the only other nuclear power in the Middle East, it won't be able to embark on these adventures in Lebanon and Gaza and elsewhere that it's doing now with impunity. It's a real shame to me that Iran should have to have a nuclear weapon in order to stop Israel from being such an aggressive state. But the alternative, which is getting Israel to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and to give up its nuclear warheads, is less likely. So it's easy to understand why Iranians would want this nuclear threshold capability, because they want to deter Israel. They want to deter aggression in the region. And that's very understandable. We also have to remember that just like in Madison, Wisconsin, where the leadership here is terrified of real democracy, the thing that frightens our foreign policy experts and our government more than anything else in the Middle East is real democracy. Because if the people of the Middle Eastern countries, the Arab world, as well as Iran, were to have a real say in what their government did, the Americans would be pushed out very, very quickly. They would not be able to dictate to various powers what they had to do. They would not be able to expropriate resources, to steal resources, to control the policies of various nations. And I think the recent Arab revolutions, if we can call them that, are an illustration of that. Hosni Mubarak was despised by his population. He was despised. He was in power for 30 years. He was a tyrant. And the Egyptian people knew and know full well that the United States supported him. And when things were uncertain as to what would happen there, but there were still popular cries every day for Mubarak's resignation, the United States stepped in and tried to be a kind of pacifier and said, okay, well, let Omar Suleiman become the new leader of Egypt. Omar Suleiman is worse than Mubarak. He was the head of the intelligence apparatus in Egypt. He was part of the extraordinary rendition program. He oversaw the torture of thousands of people, Egyptian citizens and others. This is who the Americans were promoting as the next Hosni Mubarak, and the people of Egypt would have none of it. So they got rid of Hosni Mubarak, and I can assure you that they don't want another American-propped-up dictator in power in Cairo, any more than the Iranian people want, as much as many people in Iran object to the very oppressiveness of the state within Iranian society. Most Iranians support their government, if you look at public opinion polls, and they don't want a U.S.-backed puppet in place like they did under the Shah. That was a horrible time for them. It was horrible. Brings back awful memories.
It really was, Jennifer.
Surprise.
I don't plan to move to Iran to live there, but I think I could live very comfortably and nobody would bother me. I'm Jewish. You are as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody persecutes Jews. Iran is a Muslim country. It's the Islamic Republic. That is the official name of the country.
Well, and we have to remember that there are things about Iran's government that I don't like. I want to be honest about that. I don't want to paint any government as perfect as, you know, it isn't. But the fact is that the people of Iran, the majority of Iranians, support their government. We only have to look at public opinion polls to see that. Additionally, we have to look at public opinion polls in the Arab world. And recently, there was a recent public opinion poll done by Zoghbi Institute and one done this past summer by the Brookings Institution, and both of them asked people in the Middle East and the Arab world what country they viewed as the greatest threat to the region. And believe me, the Arabs in the Arab world did not choose Iran. They don't see Iran as a threat. Maybe 10%, 20% viewed Iran as a minor threat. 80% viewed the United States as the major threat in the region.
And also Israel.
80% viewed Israel as the second major threat in the region. This is public opinion.
It's amazing, Jennifer. We are getting short on time, and I do want to get a little in on what will be happening in Wisconsin this weekend. I guess there will be more demonstrations today and tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a demonstration today that began at noon that I hope to be joining as soon as I get off the phone here. I don't know how big it's going to be, but my sense is that the momentum for these demonstrations is only building. Walker has threatened to start laying off workers if the Democratic senators that have fled the state to prevent his anti-collective bargaining bill from passing. As far as I know, they have no intention of coming back. And if Walker starts to lay people off work, I think the momentum for these demonstrations is going to build even further.
Jennifer, a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
In my article that I got out today, I mentioned the possibility that talk is going around about a general strike. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard a lot of rumors about it. And what I have heard that really doesn't fall into the category of rumor is that every person I have spoken to at the protests and in my classes, in when I'm out in the street shopping or doing errands, everybody I've spoken to supports the idea. Everybody I've spoken to supports a general strike to shut the state of Wisconsin down, to stop Walker from mowing over their rights like this. And it's important to note that Walker's ratings in the polls are dropping precipitously. Last week, 60% of the public in Wisconsin opposed his bill. I expect that those numbers to climb continually, especially if he goes ahead and starts laying off Wisconsin workers.
I hope so. That really, in my mind, that's the answer to Walker and what he wants to do. Literally shut the whole state down, bring it to a standstill, and draw a line in the sand and say, it's either our collective bargaining rights or the state of Wisconsin stays in shutdown. You choose.
That's what I have to say. I agree with that completely. I have to say, when I was talking earlier about there is no going back, that's kind of what I was getting at. We can either go back into our houses, shut our doors, turn off our radios, and let the state of Wisconsin and the United States turn itself into an oligarchy, a plutocracy, and lose more rights every day. Or we can stop right here, right now, in Madison, Wisconsin, and say, you're not going one step further with our rights. It's time to take them back. It's time for the people of Wisconsin to stand up and say, this is where your theft of our human and civil rights stops, right here.
Absolutely. And really, the power of the people is unstoppable when they literally turn their backs on the state and
when
say,
the mobilization and organization is there and there are enough people out to say, not on my life, Walker cannot win. He can't win. But it's extremely important for people to realize that now their voices are more important than ever. Voices turn into votes. Democracy threatens Walker. There's already a recall effort underway in the state for Walker, and I actually believe that it will be successful because he is becoming so despised by so many people.
If enough people want it, would there be a recall? Could it really happen?
Yes. It couldn't happen in the next few weeks, but it could happen in the next year. And as far as I'm concerned, as soon as we can recall this monster in in Madison, the better. He has no business being the governor of the people of Wisconsin.
Oh, so true, so true. And if it happened, that would be a shot across the bow for everybody in state, local government, maybe the federal government, that, look, this is what the people of Wisconsin did to somebody who absolutely went against their best interest. We can do it to you, too. That would be marvelous. Oh, I hope it happens. I'm going to be following that.
I hope what has started here in Wisconsin spreads all across the United States and that we start to see a real democratic revival take place in this country. It depends on us, on everyone of us.
Oh, it depends on us. It depends on us. And when I spoke to you on the phone during the week, you agreed, we both agreed with each other that Wisconsin is ground zero. And if it's held, if the battle is won in Wisconsin, it can be won anywhere.
Oh, absolutely. Wisconsin has a reputation for being a very radical state when it needs to be. What's a shame is that democracy ought to be considered radical. That ought to be considered mainstream. But in the world we live in, the voice of the people is the biggest threat to the corporate powers that manage our state. And as far as I'm concerned, that's going to stop.
It's got to stop, and it's up to us. There's no question. I say it repeatedly on this program. I don't want my listeners to say, "Oh my God, he's telling us again." We know. It's either the people acting in their own behalf, in their own self-interest and self-defense, or it will never happen for them. The people on the top never give anything unless they are simply forced to do it.
That's right.
It's
That's
up
exactly
to us.
Right. Tyrants don't give things to the people freely. The people have to demand them. They have to take them back. And Scott Walker is a tyrant and also, in my opinion, an occupier. I don't think he is a legitimate politician in the state of Wisconsin. I think his election was bought and stolen. A little bit of both.
Oh, absolutely.
And the sooner he's out, the happier I'll be.
Oh, I live in Illinois, but I will be ecstatic. I will declare a day of celebration if he's removed.
It will be a symbol for the whole country.
Oh,
of hope,
it surely
of,
will.
Of We're a revival of democracy, real democracy, direct democracy.
We are out of time. Oh, I will be with you in spirit at that demonstration today and tomorrow if you go back. And I think about the people of Wisconsin every single day, and I agree with your earlier comment on the program that in so many respects, Obama is worse than Bush. I have proved it in the volumes I've written about him.
Because he wears the mask of a progressive. He institutes laws, he establishes laws and approves laws that are worse than Bush's.
Absolutely. Judge them by their policies. Judge them by their policies, by their actions, and forget what they've said. We are out of time, Jennifer.
Yeah.
Good luck today. My great thanks to you, and always.
Yes, you too. Thanks very
thanks,
much.
Thanks, Jennifer. And join us tomorrow, of course, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Another terrific program. What else have you come to expect on the Progressive Radio News Hour and on PRN? Do join us.